This Week of This Life is brought to you by Alliant University School of Psychology. We encourage you to listen more about them after the break. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Flores
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around the iPhone for another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest, because people listen to their iPhones.
Oh.
Yeah, that's Candy Finnegan. Of course, you guys know her 30 years of experience, multiple certifications in addiction medicine, you know, from the A&E series intervention. Candy's husband is here, Mike Finnegan, also sober for 30-plus years. Musician, has played with Jimi Hendrix, Etta James. You know this about?
Yeah, right? I do.
Ed James, Crosby, Stills, Nash.
Last year.
Specialized in the Hammond B3 and just back from Australia where he was playing with Bonnie Raitt. Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, Australia and New Zealand and Hawaii. And I'm still trying to figure out what time it is.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I can bet. Oh, yeah. Sounds awful.
You're a doctor. What should I do? Go to bed or stay up?
Melatonin. Well, okay. Yeah. You can stay up until you can't take it anymore.
But that's what I've been doing. Yeah.
Then you'll end up waking up anyway.
One of the guys in the band I talked to the other day, and he goes, he actually emailed me at midnight and said, I've been awake for 24 hours. Ugh. I'm dead tired and hungry.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time.
Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Fantastic. Yeah. So, Candy, how are things going these days?
You know, really good. I just, intervention is taking on kind of a new persona, and, not quite sure what it's going to look like. It's still going to be the show. Uh-huh. We're still going to be intervening. But as you well know, there's a huge epidemic in the United States of
opiates.
And the Opiate Summit was just in Atlanta. And
what came out of that?
A lot of opiates, it sounds like.
You know, it really is unnerving to me. I went to the first one in Orlando 4 years ago, and then it moved to Atlanta, and it's been there ever since. And it's a whole bunch of people that talk about these tragic stories and all these kids that die and hubnub and a few cocktails, because, needless to say, they're not all in recovery. And then they all leave, and I always go, what was that?
So you know? Everyone wants to do something, but no solution. But
there's going to never be a solution if there's lobbyists and billions of dollars, as you well know.
Well, that's what I've been telling Bob. I said the Suboxone, the company that manufactures Suboxone, in concert with the government, with the National Drug Abuse, they co-created it. They're getting Bob. They're getting breaks. They don't have generics because the government is obviating all that. These guys are making billions of dollars off Suboxone. They are now mobilizing doctors that don't know anything about addiction and saying they have to have 250 patients in each practice. I was talking to Bruce Heistrober on Weekly Infusion, this other podcast we do, and he uses Suboxone. He's sort of an advocate. And I'm like, okay, everything has its place. But he was like, I go, how many Suboxone patients do you take at a time? 10. Couldn't possibly do more than that. 250.
250.
You think that's going to go okay?
You know what? In my recovery life, and working with newer guys, I've had plenty of guys that came out of a treatment center or something on Suboxone, and the idea being this is to help you initially, to my understanding, and I knew it was like a dangerous item when I heard about guys selling it to each other. Right. It's like that's a tip off, you know.
Well, now you should know what the position is of the lawyers, Bob, and the medical community, which is if you take your patient off Suboxone, you're killing them. You're actively killing them.
If you take them off.
If you take them off.
Even after a year.
Well.
Even after any time, because they will relapse and they will die. Period. You killed them.
You.
That's not true.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that. But believe me, I understand that. But that's the current. So now, let's say I go out and I try to get them off. I get them off the med. And the patient has a complication and dies. The liability is reckless negligence now.
On you.
On me.
That's ridiculous.
That's Bob?
Well, that sounds like of a piece of any, when the national government being involved in the problem of addiction. You know, we've got Jeff Sessions who, every time I hear him talk, I think I've been thrown back into 1936.
You know,
all begins with the marijuana, and then they start listening to the swing music, and the next thing you know, they're dancing with colored people.
That's funny. That's really
that
funny.
Was a quote from.
And this is a guy that's going to talk to us about drugs. Please give me a break.
Or Christy.
Who we're going to talk to.
We're talking to Christy on Monday.
He's Chris actually, Christy,
but he's actually he's in our court.
He's got the mind of a chicken.
But he's at least in our court. He's like
I knew this was going to be a good show.
But let me say one thing.
He couldn't tell the truth on. He'd rather climb a tree to lie if he could get his big ass up one than to tell the truth on purpose. You know?
Now you be nice. God. But you know what I was going to say to you is that I talked to the head in this small community suburb of Atlanta. I talked to the head narcotic guy, and he said to me, "Well, there's going to be an epidemic pretty soon." And I said, "Pretty soon? What are you talking about? We're in one." He goes, "Oh, another one."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "Crack cocaine." And I said, "Is that because they can use crack cocaine and when they're on Suboxone?"
Yes.
He said, "Oh, I don't think that's true. That's rumor."
It's 100%
true. And I said,
100%
true.
Let me tell you,
I did it. But good.
Bobby's
works.
It does work.
Yeah.
And you can smoke pot.
Buprenorphine and crack. I used to put coke in the buprenorphine.
Well, of course you did. Only you
bless
do
your
that.
Soul.
You know, don't
bless
waste anything.
That's good. I don't want to encourage any of the kids at
don't,
home.
Don't give them any ideas.
I
now,
know.
They're using drugs now that I never even heard of.
Right.
Which makes me feel cheated somehow.
But, you know, it was like I thought, this is the guy that's head of this, you know, county that has a huge epidemic. And I said, maybe you should go look that up. I said, works on your opiate receptors. Oh, that's right. Crack's a stimulant. And I went.
So Candy.
And they don't screen them for anything except opiates when they come back to see if they're complying.
The thing we've been talking about is the millennials, right? There's something, I don't know how many millennials you're dealing with in a case management basis.
I had two of them at home.
Okay.
But they're not.
Enough said then.
Yeah, but they're not. She's not dealing with them in, you know, in terms of staying sober.
Yeah.
Not so much? How come?
Well, they're sober.
Your kids. No, I mean, but out there in the world when you do.
No.
But the thousands and thousands, they make up 70% of the rehab market.
Wow.
They don't have the fundamentals that the 12-step philosophy is built on.
They reject it.
No, they just don't have the fundamentals. They weren't our society has. They have no ambition. Everything sucks.
You sound like Plato.
That's what I'm talking about.
Socrates.
We're talking about what do we do moving forward to instill. Tell the story at the business school.
I was just saying.
He just spoke to a group full of the high-functioning millennials. Tell them what they said.
And they're just
watch
very.
Watch this.
They sent him too authoritarian.
Dr. Drew is too authoritarian.
Too authoritarian.
What and what way that you had?
Because
he has a brain. Did you like say this is this
an
is
expert
some true
at
stuff?
Something.
Yeah,
you told them the truth, and they thought that was authoritarian. Huh?
Yes, it's exactly right. And I'm not Google. You know what I mean? I'm not a whole slew of nonsense that I'm asking them to choose amongst. I'm telling them the truth, and that's how dare you.
Let me say something really quickly, Mike.
What kind of class was that?
I had a series of lectures I gave to from high school to business school, and I had that experience across all ages, from 18 to 28. That's what I experienced. Was this sort of
tell us?
And the thought bubble over my head in almost every interaction was it's sort of a curious like who do you think you are?
Somebody that's been, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I learned a few things. This is what I got for you.
That's what I would say. And that's
authoritarian. Let me just say something that Mike pointed out to me about, maybe it was about 5 or 6 months ago. He helps a lot of people in his recovery life. Yeah. And he said to me, the most disturbing thing to me, Candy, is all of these people, particularly, you know, all these guys that I'm trying to help, they've all been institutionalized.
Yes.
And, you know, so he had this kind of this guy that he'd worked with for a long time. The minute that he was going to get out of sober living and have to go back home and act like a father, I doubt a husband and maybe a son. And by the grace of God, his parents, his dad had money because he had totally supported his kid. He would relapse and then he'd go right back. Now, that's one problem. But the other problem is all these treatment centers taking him back. 5 times this kid did this in 2 years.
Well,
and so what do we do with that?
Well, you know, that's $1 million question. This guy understands on an intellectual level, like when I talk to him, like you notice a pattern here, you know,
we see that.
Like, let me draw it out for you on a piece of paper. This, and then this happens. And what it has to do with mainly is a 26-year-old guy that's never really had a job to speak of. And that's a situation
that's a common thing.
Yeah, where he looks out at the world and with those eyes and says, I can't do it. You know, I don't know what it is. I don't know how to do it. I haven't got any idea.
Don't know where to
start. And he's a smart guy. I mean, basic, you know, innate intelligence is there, certainly, and maybe some talent, which has yet to be discovered because he hasn't done anything except get loaded since he was 14. So there's no way of knowing. And I've tried to explain that, too. Like, who knows? You might be introduced to yourself at someday if you, you know, do something other than go through this, you know, this treadmill that you've been on for so long of get sober, stay sober for a period of time, start to, like, graduate into the world, and then turn, you know, because of fear, essentially, the unknown, you
but
know, run
no
back
into
it. A, go hide in a bottle again, you know.
But there's no shame in it. I mean, I would have been so horrified.
Well, I think there's shame in it.
Oh, you
I think
do? Oh.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't.
But it's like...
Not being able to take care of yourself at 26 years old should be shameful.
Well, yes, it should be. But I understand it.
You know what I mean?
I
understand how he feels because, you know, and it's the usual, you know, the old caricature of the egomaniac with the inferiority complex.
Yes,
you know,
like, that's what it is.
You know,
I don't think they have low self-esteem.
Well, you know, here's what I think. You know, it's like... It's like the old joke of, you know, am I a piece of crap or the greatest person on earth, you know, or Mr. Wonderful? And I said, well, you're a wonderful piece of crap at this point. So, you know,
or what my patients say, I feel like a piece of shit around which the whole world revolves.
Right.
That's the old model. The new model is I'm great. The world is a piece of shit. That's what they believe.
Well, I don't know about they, but because I like to go on a case-by-case basis. It's kind of like the way I work with guys that are newly sober is, you know, there's only 6 inches between a kick in the ass and a pat on the back. And so, you know, like some people need different things. Yeah. And, you know, my idea is, you know, I don't like to broad brush any group of people because, like, once you pull them out of that group and it's just me and you, or me and you in a recovery community that is demonstrating and modeling some other kind of behavior, maybe, you know, they're going to be able to grasp that. What you said about they don't have any of the fundamentals of 12-step, you know, well, a lot of people knew what the – I mean, I think most people know that it's better to tell the truth than to lie. I think most people understand that. Some people may not.
I'm not saying
you know,
that.
Some
I'm
people
not,
may,
speaking. I'm not saying they don't understand the 12-step. I'm saying they don't have the fundamentals of personal responsibility.
Well, that's pretty much the way a drug addict behaves, you know.
Yeah, so then they'll just be excused till
until someone says you have to, you know. Or, you know, and the thing about it is I think that when people are exposed to that, and a lot of people, not all, but a few, like obviously the numbers are low, but, you know, I think recovery can be progressive too,
but
in the sense of, you know, it feels good, you know. In other words, once you have a few months of right, of good behavior and right action, then, oh, you know, it encourages itself somewhat. That's my experience.
I agree with you on that. But right now there is something about, and particularly the males I think you're thinking of, Bob, and their place in the world. I'm just thinking right now, what occurred to me was the rehab group we treated. We did a non-celebrity group of rehabs. There were a lot of millennials in that group. and well, that's all we used to do is only that. But yeah, everyone said, why don't you treat non-celebrities? So we treated a non-celebrity group on TV. Nobody watched. So anyway, so we did it, and we treated them for a long time afterwards. We would go to their sober living. We'd see them. We'd meet with them. And down the street, literally 500 yards away, was a Starbucks. I went down there. I got the applications. They said they would hire any of our people from the sober living that showed up. And how many of them filled out the application?
None.
Zero.
Is that right?
Because
this, well, that's not good enough for those guys, right?
Well, that's the problem. But that's the problem.
And they pay for college and a few other things.
But that's what we're right, and health care and everything.
Where Nate the man
and,
went.
And so, Bob, that's the thing.
I met Nate, you know. He was working at Starbucks.
It's fantastic. But well, I think right in there is the problem. They feel they're too well educated or too entitled or too whatever. And so they don't know how to get started in life anywhere. They just
that's one of the things that, you know, that's one of the things that 12 steps is supposed to instill. In other words, like, you know, take one right action.
Yeah.
You know, take one step. You know, what is it? The longest journey begins with the first step, you know? Or what's the other? I can't remember. There's a joke in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's in a way, it's being able to manage overwhelming tasks.
You have to have faith.
In other words, you don't forget about the big picture. How about the small picture? What have you done today?
Well, but you know, one thing I want to say.
Today's the day. You know, this is the day. No other day matters. How about today? What are you going to do today? How about getting up off your dead ass and doing something? Because it will feel good, actually.
Well, let me just say, one of the things that has happened to me, at least when I go nationally, and you probably know this, both of you guys, all of you, because you don't talk too much about recovery when you're on tour. But, you know, the thing about it is that you're either a Christian and you were raised in this kind of fundamentalist household, or you have had no spiritual or religious training. I met this kid a couple of weeks ago, and he's 18, and he said, If my parents wouldn't have wanted me to go to church, I'd have been raised in one. I don't want to go to there. And what it really was, I found out, is he's so embarrassed he doesn't know the Lord's Prayer. Because, you know, kind of everybody else.
Well, you don't have to say it anyway.
Well, but I said, you know, then, you know, ask him if at the end of it, until you can learn it, they play the Serenity Prayer. Don't, you know, that's stopping.
Actually, that's a more common thing around the country and the world is the Serenity Prayer.
I know.
Well, most, you know, you don't know the, who cares, you know.
He didn't know where to find
you.
I'll tell you what,
this is something, we're getting to that point we talked about that podcast with Eden, which is that it feels to me, and you guys, I love your opinion on this, and I've been thinking a lot about this lately, and I've been asking everybody about it, just seeing what we come up with, but it feels like we need a new narrative in this country. It's like our old narratives aren't working anymore, and I kind of feel like we sort of had a hero cultural archetype going into the Second World War. We came out of that. We came out with sort of an anti-hero, drugs and sex, and, you know,
rock and roll,
and that sort of anti-social became the hero. And this is all burning out now, and we now fractured into all right and all left, and these extreme positions. What's a new narrative or new archetype that we think these people, young people, could grab onto?
I said wisdom.
Well, he said Solomon.
Wisdom.
Solomon. He said Solomon. Solomon is sort of the idea. We were with Eden Sassoon, who said she thought Athena, the myth of Athena, was something that would be good. I don't know. It's going to happen, whatever it is. But don't you guys feel like we're sort of in a state of lack
well,
of
I feel that to some extent. But what I feel more than that is belligerent ignorance is really popular now. You know,
that's what he wanted me to tell you the story about when I was talking to those kids. They were belligerently ignorant.
Well, you know,
that's exactly right.
That's become okay.
That's very scary. It's become okay.
That'd be a great name for a band.
And I mean, it's
Men Without Legs is my favorite.
That's been reflected in our politics. It's writ large in our politics.
French.
You know,
in the French.
Yes, French. I mean, in our politics and
Brexit.
All of those things.
So wisdom would make a sensible alternative.
Well, respect of wisdom.
Yeah.
Let's start with respect.
I mean, yesterday was a march on science. Like I saw a sign that said, "Knowing things is good." and then under it said, geez, why do I have to say that?
That's really funny.
But,
I mean, now we have a culture now where knowing things is
arrogant. Is arrogant.
Well, you can be authoritarian.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or knowing things is not necessary. I don't know I don't know anything about government. I don't know anything about the way government works. I can't even tell you the name of the Speaker of the House on Tuesday, but I'm the president.
Yeah.
You know, in the United States, it's like 6 years ago, a guy named Dan O'Sullivan wrote on Twitter, because he said, America is literally so stupid that they will elect Donald Trump president. And, you know, that was in 2011. The thread that was after that, we're like telling him why he was wrong. But so the new narrative ought to be, knowing things is good. Like, you know, is a good
or
thing.
Or how about respecting people that know things?
Right.
Listening to people that know
right.
things. Because the whole phenomenon of experience and wisdom, they don't differentiate between knowledge and experience. So they have zero experience, tons of knowledge, and there's this gap.
And they're equal.
So, right. They're so somebody equal. Coming in with experience has no better value than my Google search.
Well, that's a real mistake, because in my business, in the music business, respect is accorded to people with experience, because, the proof is in the pudding. For, you know, especially if you're a musician in this day and age. If you want to, you want to go into the music business, whatever that might be right now, goddamn if I can tell you. But, really people funny. That are successful in the business over a long period of time, you listen to them, because, it's a mystery, man.
Better be a judge on The Voice, Bob.
That'd be a real judge.
That kind of a model is complete nonsense. Has nothing to do with reality. It's arbitrary and doesn't reflect anything true about music.
It's like American Idol.
Or about making a living as a musician.
I deal with a lot of young people in music, right? The same.
In what capacity? They own an instrument?
Watch this stuff. Watch. And I try to introduce them to John Prine, Bob Dylan, real songwriting. And they're not interested in it. So we've, across the board, you have a generation of young people who are not interested in greatness, in knowledge, in experience.
Well, what are they interested in?
They're interested in fame.
No, but I mean, what money? Kind of music? When they reject John Prine, so what is it they like as an alternative?
They like Beyonce. Almost all kids across the board love Beyonce.
Well, that's fine. Write a song that fits her bag.
But
you can't hear that.
Yeah, but it's not songwriting. It's just mimicry.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Well, creativity begins with imitation. You know, it always does.
I believe it begins with absorption of things that you
love. Yeah, but imitation is the father of creation. Hmm. You have to, in other words, if you're an artist of any kind, the thing that inspires you is the thing that's going to, whether it's in painting or in music or in any other field of the art, the originality comes with the mastery of craft. Craft is content, and the mastery of craft begins with imitation. This is my star right here.
Yeah.
This guy or this woman. This woman is the woman that I admire most. Inspires. This is what I want to do. This is what it has inspired me to begin this process. Yeah. And that it's only natural that imitation is going to be first. And then what happens after that is a matter of time and a matter of how much creative energy and how much talent this person actually has. Is it going to evolve past imitation or not? Mm-hmm. But it always begins with imitation.
Well, music nowadays is imitation.
It's always been that way to some extent.
Samples of, you at least had to play your instrument. You didn't have to just sample
something.
Well,
Bob Dylan didn't play that good, but he could write,
Yeah,
he could write, though, and then he played better as he went, But when he first started, he was writing brilliant songs when he could hardly play, really. Mm-hmm. But he had vast experience, and he had a huge listening life. In terms of the things that he listened to, everything from Lydon and Hopkins to Woody Guthrie and so on and so forth, he wasn't like just locked into a certain thing. He was listening to
be fair,
all
though,
popular American music.
He came out of the 50s and 60s when the word literary expression was a revered form of what we call communication and art.
Yes.
I mean, the word, I didn't realize, I watched some documentaries about, you know, Greenwich Village in the 50s and 60s and stuff, that everybody would just read and then sit around about and dream about being a writer.
That's your secret word right there. Read.
I know.
And dream,
Dream, but they dreamt about expressing with words. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, to me, as a non-musician, to me, I think of Bob Dylan more as a poet that happened to play music. You know what I mean?
Well, to some extent,
and wrote some
that's
great
true.
Songs
but, I mean, his poetry, his lyrics don't hold up as well on the page as they do in the song.
I agree. But it's the two that made him great.
Yeah.
But I think he had a deep, profound, you know, respect for the word. And
we
came out of it. It doesn't exist anywhere. Words don't matter at all. Do words matter at all?
Well, I'm going to see Kendrick Lamar tonight.
I think he's very good with words.
Yeah, he really is. And he is probably the person of words right now.
And he's multi talented in terms of expression within all kinds of platforms.
So there's hope.
There's hope.
Oh, absolutely. And I think
I think
there's a lot of hope in his new album. You know, the album is spiritual, I think. I think that he's coming at the idea of spirituality, the idea of, you know, I mean, the
healing,
names of the tune.
Healing.
Yeah.
You know, and then the idea of, and there's a lot of hope in what, and like, we going to be all right.
Yeah.
You know, that's
the new, you know, he wrote the anthem that's the new We Shall Overcome. Mm. It's called We Going to Be All Right.
Nice. Yeah. We're going to be all right after we get back from this break. Now, one of the most amazing parts of working in treatment is seeing a number of former patients successfully move on and choose to become mental health professionals themselves. Yes, I've seen it. And the field of psychology is vast, and the need for competent practitioners has not been greater and never been greater. If you're considering this rewarding career, I suggest you look at the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. I've been familiar with Alliant for some time now. I've spoken at their events. It was founded in 1969, boasts an alumni network of nearly 50,000 people worldwide. Alliant has fostered many of today's mental health pioneers, authors, and advocates. CSPP at Alliant University hosts both on-ground and online programs in business psychology, marriage and family therapy, clinical counseling. They also offer an APA-accredited doctoral program in clinical psychology that allows for specialization in child psychology, clinical forensic psychology, and integrated psychology. Faculty is industry leaders. Former faculty includes names like Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Viktor Frankl. Come on now. Those are names everyone's heard, some of the fathers of modern psychology. For more information on the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant, check the Alliant banner on my site or visit Alliant, Alliant.edu. That is Alliant.edu.
And we're back. So I want to tell Candy about this organization I started.
All right, okay.
What's the most corrupt part of the recovery industry? The call center.
That's where it starts.
I like it. Yes, right? And answered.
Well, but where does it start? That's where it starts.
Yes. And so I and a couple of my friends started a nonprofit call center that gets people Medicaid, Blue Cross, HMO. We'll find treatment for them, right?
Everybody.
It's called the National Addiction Foundation. And it just started about 4 months ago. We've already found 71 Medicaid people treatment.
Wow.
And you'll love this. So I'm dealing with an old friend of mine that's been going in and out, right? He calls me all desperate, and he has Medi-Cal. And I said, well, give me a couple days. I'm going to talk to Megan. I'm going to figure it out. Get him a place in Texas that will take him. He goes, I don't want to go to fucking Texas.
Well, that's not, you know, that sounds typical, doesn't it?
Right. So
I want that? Malibu.
Right. Yeah,
get the chariot, man, you know.
This is one F word. That's all right. All right.
Get the chariot.
But you know, it's trying to clean things up. It's hard. You know.
Well, I have to tell you a funny story. This the show was looking for new interventionists. I said, you mean ones with tattoos and holes in their ears and aren't going to be 70? Okay, new look. And he said, we found this guy, and he named this guy. And I said, you can't hire that guy. First of all, he's not an interventionist. Second of all, he has a call system in Orange County, and you have to pay him $2,500 to have him. That's what the treatment center's paying him. And he goes, oh, Candy, that's nonsense. And I said, have somebody call up and fake it. He goes, you mean not be honest and say they needed help? I thought, what? You running a TV show, buddy?
Not be honest. If you're lying, you fit right in.
You know, and so he, you know, he wouldn't do it. Because he thought, you know, if they ever found out that he did, I said, I'll do it, okay?
Unethical,
you know?
Right.
So I did it, and so he goes, yeah, you can go here, and you can go here, and the secret word was, you don't need to worry about a thing. We'll get you some insurance. Now it's not the treatment center that's getting the insurance, it's the...
call center, right. So, you know, just trying to do the right
how
thing.
Are you going, how are you guys doing something different?
That we're getting, that. Whoever calls gets connected
gets
to
help.
Treatment.
Yeah.
And it's not for profit. And it mostly is trying to take back the reins. What I don't like is sober people aren't in charge of the sober recovery world anymore. It's all equity funds.
Yeah. Big money.
And so to try to empower mom and pops again, that's what I'm trying to do. Mm. Because mom and pops can't compete with these huge marketing fees that these rehabs pay. Mm-hmm. So great places like CryHelp, right? Impact.
The ranch.
The ranch. See, she'll tell you the ranch
the
is
ranch
the same.
The ranch takes Medicare
Medicaid.
And Medi-Cal.
Yeah.
Good.
Facebook question. My daughter
question
has
here.
Illness, bipolar, and she's a meth heroin addict. Oh. She's on Medi-Cal, and there's nowhere I can send her to get help.
The ranch.
Oh, there are places.
For the psych stuff.
Here's what it is.
Los Encinas.
Yeah. Well, the problem with the bipolar is you can't really tell if they're bipolar.
If they're on meth. Yeah,
as long as they're on drugs. Let's do a diagnosis in 6 months.
That's exactly my point. But 100% the foundation would be able to place her.
Yes.
And that's the whole point is that this is why I like what they're doing. It's like, I couldn't find placement for a family member. It's so difficult, so cumbersome to do it, that they're doing it and taking responsibility and following through to me is a big deal. It's a big deal.
You know, you said something, I don't know, years and years and years ago, it was that made so much sense to me, that said, the only thing you really have to do is care and stay at it, because eventually you can ask people for scholarships. They have them. You know, if you've got somebody dying, ask somebody for help. And
no,
I don't
right.
know what situation it was.
No, that's always been the people that are really motivated find treatment.
You bet.
They find treatment.
You bet.
And how many times have you and I, you know, queued them up at CryHelp or something, and then they just don't follow through?
Yeah,
you know,
that's
what I've told guys, too. Like, you got to keep calling.
Well, they got to go on the heat.
And by the way, and the programs don't want to hear from somebody else. They want to know that you want that.
Oh, bed. Yeah, they won't allow it. Yeah. But one of the things I always say, CryHelp's doing this new thing where they tell them there's an 8-week waiting list. Yeah. And then the guy will call me and goes, I can't even get even a bed for 8 weeks. I go, dude, they tell everybody that because they want to see if you're willing.
Right.
Call tomorrow morning.
Well, that's the Tarzana model.
Well, that's, you know, that's. I think that's well known. I tell guys, I'm just a guy working with other guys, and that's what I tell them too. You keep calling, and I've got a couple guys that did that, and they're still sober.
This is an email at dr.com/contact. It's all right. No, I'm reading emails.
Yeah,
22-year-old daughter needs help. I don't have money. We're Medi-Cal. She has Medi-Cal. Keep calling places, getting phone number after phone number. No one helps. Please, I'm begging. I don't have $1,000 a day.
Yeah.
Which is what people think it's going to
call the National Addiction Foundation, and they got places in. Now here's the thing, and you were spot
Say
on
that again. Call the National
Addiction
Foundation.
It's a nonprofit that I'm started, and the problem is we have places in Michigan, in Texas that will take Medicaid. The people have to pay for their transportation. I always say, you know, I don't.
Unless you
know
go to Florida.
I mean? It's $180 to take a Greyhound bus to Michigan.
It's so important I flew United. How's that?
It's so desperate.
Are you one of the
I flew United. You know?
Mike, did you piss off that flight attendant before she tagged that guy? Was that you?
Here, I really want to sober up. I'm flying United.
This is a really good question. This is a good one. You guys all like this. Hi, I'm working in the Human Services Program with 2 years of sobriety and 12-step, very involved. I'm having a hard time finding the separation between helping professionally and in a 12-step fashion. I'm even questioning if chemical dependency is the road for me. How can I get this inner struggle of 12-step and morphing into the guidelines of professional helping? I think behind that, too, is a feeling of codependency that's starting to express itself that needs some treatment.
If I don't get them help, they'll never
that's
get help.
Right. That's right.
I learned from Buddy. Buddy goes,
Arnold.
Your first thing is recovery. Other than that's the gift, you know. You aren't getting anybody sober. You aren't intervening on anybody. You are the messenger. other than that, just do what you know. But don't ever forget about your own recovery. You know,
so focus on her recovery. Go to some Al-Anon meetings. Continue to advocate 12-step, but know you aren't in control.
Even
of
more
this.
Practical, I stopped going to the big speaker meetings and go to more male. I changed my meetings up because the big, huge ones I'd always gone to, Rodeo or Third and Gardner, that's where people would know I was there, and I can get people in through MAP. And I just thought, and it was the right time in my sobriety that I just switched to men's stags,
that's all
smaller.
That's all
right?
I've been doing for like the last 20 years.
And that's all I've done. We haven't been to a meeting together in 19 years.
I'm not interested. I mean, that's where I get fed. The other kind of things are fun, and I'll speak at them. You know, it's not like.
How are you going to complain about him if you go to a meeting with him?
I have to correct him. That isn't how it was.
We never have gone to meetings. Well, we did the first couple of years.
We went to the musicians' meeting.
But I understand, you know,
girls
I'm not
aren't
even
allowed
a professional.
At the Monday night meeting.
Where's your mic? Hang on.
Which I think is.
Hang on.
Dallas didn't like
it. They've got a private joke going over there. There's a. I
There's
understand
a private
what she's
meeting
saying.
We were talking about, Mike.
I'm not a professional, but we're living with her, with Candy, I understand the problem. And I sponsor guys that are professional now, that have gone back to school and gotten their masters and are working in the field, and they've had, you know, there's a high percentage of recidivism in the professional area. I mean, people that are sober people working. That happens a lot because the confusion between taking care of them and taking care of me is so.
What did I always yell at you guys when we were running a program together?
Yeah.
What did I say?
Got to take care of your own sobriety.
I said, go to Al-Anon. These people will take you out.
Yeah, that's true. And not to mention the confusion about whether or not me helping them is actually taking care of me.
Right.
That's not 12-step work. That's your professional life.
And you have to have deep humility, too, because even the patients that had the best sobriety always come back to me and go, you didn't do anything. They'd always say that. I go, I don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I wish that they would start a meeting for professionals.
Probably no human power could relieve us of our alcoholism. And my sponsor used to say, probably no human power, even Finnegan. You know, don't take any swinging bows. You know, your job is to carry a message. That's all.
Yeah.
Here's a little hint that you need to do. On your way back sometime soon, you need to go to the Riverside Social Services Mental Health Division. They're the ones that are fielding all the phone calls for that area, you know, Riverside and
San
Palm
Bernardino.
Springs and Indio and all that, because ABC takes Medicare, and so does the ranch now.
They
have a central that you get assessed there because it takes so long to do all that. And then they either divide them into the women's or men's program at the ranch, or they send them to ABC, which has a plethora. I mean, like a senior, women with children, all that kind of
women
program.
With children out there?
Yeah, right. With ABC. So, and it's all been changed.
That's been a new high need, is women and addicts, women and their children.
It's kind of
more so
there.
Than ever before.
Like it's always been around.
No, yeah. Miriam.
Well, New Directions.
Miriam, but that
New Directions I've been
to...
sending people to for years. New Directions and New Visions and places like that, yeah. But let me ask something. I treated a few people for really neurological illness that flew out of the Joe Cocker and Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour. Brains were broken.
Yeah.
Ended up in nursing homes, young people. And I understand you worked with him too.
I worked with Joe, but not in that period. I worked with him after he got sober, which was he sobered up. Mostly, he stopped drinking, he stopped using all drugs, but he continued to smoke marijuana occasionally. Which as far as I was concerned, is like. Fine.
Yeah.
He was, a drunk of another kind.
Like, I called him a heroic drunk.
Oh yeah, well, those guys.
I mean, like he did like
epic
things. Mm-hmm. And but I worked with him from 2007 till late 2011, and but I heard plenty about that period. And of course, I had some friends that were involved in that too. So, I mean, I'm pretty old.
Well, the magnitude of hallucinogen exposure then was when it that group started making it clearer to the psychiatric community down here in Southern California just what the spectrum of neurological injury is from hallucinogen. That was where I first found psychiatrists talking about it. They were like,
really?
Oh, yeah, this LSD is very,
they
very...
They were talking about it, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's something Joe never did. I think maybe once or twice, and he said that was enough, but because he was a booze guy, but and maybe a few pills, depending on what you got in your pocket. And but he said, like, at Woodstock, he said things were kind of, when he performed there, he told me that things were really weird. And he goes, he found out later that everybody, and that was like 11 in the morning or something, that everyone in the band had taken LSD except him.
Sure.
He said, which is not that much fun, you know.
I have to tell you something about Joe Cocker. He was such an intellectual.
Well, this is what the I watched the documentary because I just
got out.
Yeah, and they said he was so vibrant and so thoughtful and so expressive the way he could so speak.
Oh yes,
and so thinking about everything.
He was a smart guy.
Yeah. He was quite a reader. We were good friends when I worked with him because we both liked to read, and he was a very passionate guy about a lot of subjects, but also kind of taciturn, really, in terms of his public persona.
It became that way anyway.
Well, yeah, he didn't. The only talking he did on stage was introducing the band, except once in a while he'd make a comment, which was always funny and spot on. Except the audience.
Didn't get it.
And like I told him, I said, you know what Lenny Bruce said, if the band laughs, you're in trouble.
Did you ever see the Mad Dogs Englishman tour?
I have the movie. Yeah. I have the DVD, yeah.
You should see it.
Well, I was a huge fan of Leon Russell. I saw him 20 times. I just love Leon. And he was like...
He was the ringleader.
He was the maestro.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Of chaos, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go, buddy.
No, it was a circus.
Well, he was the guy that pulled everyone together, and he was, you know...
You seen that weird new movie that he shot in 73 that came out?
No, I haven't seen
it. It's unbelievable how he was living in some... In Arkansas or Oklahoma
Tulsa,
but on a lake... And it was so Grand weird, Lake. The people that were living in his house and people...
Is it a documentary?
Like, yeah. Well, it's like a 70s documentary.
It's like a whole movie.
It has its own narrative, which I couldn't quite follow.
Well, people living in your house, which so you know...
Wow. But they emptied the swimming pool out, and they had a dining room table in the swimming
bottom
pool.
Of it, yeah.
That was a period of time when a lot of people did things just for effect. Wouldn't it be weird if we
drained the swimming
pool? Too much acid.
But acid was behind all that weird
stuff.
Well,
that's where you get your best ideas, right? Or at least that's what you think.
That's when I know if somebody's not really into 12 step and they go, well, Dr. Bob took acid.
Oh, yeah.
And I always go,
not Dr. Bob.
Bill Wilson.
Dr. Bob should
corrected you.
Yes, Bill Wilson. And I go, and?
Yeah. Though I would have liked to have seen Dr. Bob on acid.
Too. That's what I was thinking. That's how I had that vision.
Well, that's a controversy that is kind of
hanging
pointless because he was, I'm sure you know this about, you've probably talked about it.
How, about Bill W.?
Yeah.
Well, there's controversy about his hallucinogen use and his sexual improprieties.
Those improprieties, if you read page 69 to the end of the chapter, he's pretty much talking about himself.
Most of the time.
And which is okay. Like the notion that an alcoholic has character defects should not come as a shock to anyone.
Right.
Even one of the co-founders, it's like, really? He had shortcomings. Huh?
Yeah. And he had trouble staying sober? No way.
That's like, really wild.
Of course he did.
But the hallucinogen thing had to do with the idea of deflation at depth, which the people that were experimenting with LSD and learning about it in that period, which, if I'm correct, was the early 50s, I think, when he was exposed to it, had told him that there was a possibility that it might be useful in the treatment of
alcoholism.
Because of the fact that it could maybe induce this kind of ego deflation that was necessary for a real surrender. If not a spiritual experience, a surrender, a realization and some of the notes that Bill took, according to the things I've read, that while he was experiencing that, his acid trip, which was supervised. And
well, how about the fact it reminds me of something, you know, when I think about
and
acid.
Set and setting, it was called. Well, it was in a doctor's office.
Listen, I think hallucinogens will have use in end of life.
They're doing it with veterans. Yeah. With
well,
they're
using
it.
PTSD. They're using it for depression,
but,
I think.
What occurs to me, though, is, yes, they're using it for depression.
And the veterans and trauma.
And PTSD.
PTSD.
But, and I think it's probably going to end up being better for PTSD than depression. But what it does occur to me is how, you know, bizarre it is that doctors can't do the research on a chemical because people moralize on chemicals.
Right.
It's weird. Those of us that are around addicts or have addiction or whatever, there's no moral issue except how the disease makes you behave immorally.
Of course.
But the morality of a human's relation with a chemical has no moral context, no moral element to it.
That's been an obstacle to recovery.
Yeah.
It's certainly been an obstacle to... Speaking of narratives, you know, the narrative for drug addiction, you know, the narrative for what the problem is and what the solution is, has been completely, there's huge obstacles because of the political.
And the laws.
The politicization of the problem and government bad information, you know, disseminated over periods of decades, wrong. You know, completely wrong. And now, like, once again, I hate to keep banging on him, but Jeff Sessions, we've got, you know, he's a
banger.
By the way, Mike,
he's
Mike,
a Neanderthal.
On behalf of your program of Rigorous Honesty, you don't mind banging on him. You don't hate to bang on him.
No, but I mean, because he's an obstacle. You know, he's not helpful. And nobody else is that is buying into all these old ideas that have been debunked over and over again, and especially with regard to morality.
I wish we could change the narrative. Trauma causes addiction, not marijuana.
Well, trauma.
Trauma.
Or just being a pig.
Yeah, yeah, right. So trauma, trauma ignites
but
addiction.
Trauma,
it ignites
but yet
it.
We don't seem real focused in this country on nurturing and treatment for trauma.
Well,
we don't even consider
well,
it a thing.
Well, you know, what it says in the brochure is we do EMDR.
Right, right.
Give it up.
That's a new sexy version.
Which unfortunately, the really sad part about that is you can't do trauma treatment until they've been sober a year or two. And it can make things worse.
I understand, yes.
We've seen it.
Oh, we always said, what I would do with patients, I'd go, look, here's your trauma. You've discussed this with me, and it's had an impact on you. That's why you were unregulated. That's why you're looking for solutions. And now you're a drug addict. And now we must deal with that. This trauma thing, you can talk about it, but don't talk about it too much because it's going to make you feel like shit and want to use. So talk about it a little bit. Realize it's there. Realize you share that with your peers and that they support and understand it. Nothing wrong with you. We'll deal with it in a year.
But how do you feel about these treatment centers?
I understand that, and I agree.
And by the way, my patients typically, if the really sober ones, will go, you know what, I don't really remember the first 2 years.
Yeah.
I don't remember them.
How do you feel about these treatment centers that are trauma centers?
Well,
it's a marketing gimmick.
No, I disagree.
No.
Because occasionally, let me talk about one that I have some respect for, which is occasionally I get people who start slipping and sliding around later. They've had lots of sobriety under their belt, but they're sliding around, and it does seem to be around the trauma. Then I'm happy for places like the Meadows. Then I'm like, let's go there. Let's spend a couple of weeks. Let's dig into this trauma thing. Let me expose you to what the treatment is. And then for the next 2 years, you can work on that somewhere else.
Well,
but you need to get landed
right now.
Give
you some tools.
Yeah,
it changed me.
So I think the trauma stuff has utility, but like – it's a tapestry. I keep using that word. We need a tapestry. We need lots of different things.
Yeah, like,
with different
people. They, you know, don't get hung up on this is it.
Yeah, yeah.
But 10 years ago,
no,
it was codependency.
And 20 years ago, it was Bradshaw. Flavors come and they go. But one thing that I think is never changed until now
Candy and Mike.
What are the
goals? Those
are
the two things that don't come and go. They don't come and go.
What are the goals that we're trying to achieve right now? Because the problem is so desperate, survival is becoming the goal.
Okay, so
instead of thriving.
Bob, I want you to know
that fully realize self.
I want you to know that is the opening to my presentation in New Jersey.
Oh.
That is it. What are we doing here?
Right.
What are
we doing? What you said a minute ago is like, put that to the side. Number one, here's what'll kill you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Drug addiction.
You know? Well, but my profession will look at that and go, well, then we got to save lives. So we're going to put you on some methadone or some Suboxone, and that will save your life. And my question is, I ain't interested in that. I want to restore people to flourishing more than they ever knew they could. That
well, of course,
me.
But first of all, we have to start with this.
Yes, yes, but you we know. Got it. But I'm sure that I'm not sure that putting but you on something.
No, of course not. I don't think that's the answer. Sometimes it might be helpful, as we were talking about Suboxone.
Yeah, yeah, some people.
Yeah, it's
but
useful for some people in some circumstances.
But Bob, the one thing I want to say to them is like, you know, when we were dealing with heroin addicts hand over fist, we dealt with, you know, thousands of heroin addicts, you and I. And the one thing that never crossed my mind was, geez, I need some way of detoxing them better. It never crossed my mind.
No.
We had no trouble detoxing any. Did we ever? I mean,
never.
It was unpleasant, but it was never a problem.
Tough.
Yeah, it's like it was a problem.
4 or 5 days.
Well, it's kind of like the invention of that drug that helps people with opioid-induced constipation.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell?
Oh,
we don't need that drug.
When that comes on, he goes out.
You know, this is where it's come to. You know, are you
Super
addicted
Bowl.
To opioids? You're
on
probably having trouble on the toilet. You know,
let's fix that.
Here, we got the answer for you right here. The side effects are leaking anus.
Didn't Suboxone have the largest incentive program there's ever been in a pharmaceutical company?
With NIDA. It's been unbelievable. And the fact that that's gone under the radar to me is...
Volcal.
Well, Nora is a wonderful scientist.
No, she started getting wobbly 10 years ago.
Not a clinician. Not a clinician.
Money.
No, I don't, because she doesn't personally benefit from it. I think she believes that.
But she believed in it.
I think she believes this is the thing. And
they don't like our 20% success rate.
Right.
They don't like it.
Right.
What are you talking
about?
What?
The good treatment in America, I always think, runs at about 20%
success
rate.
Okay, yeah. They think that's
not
good
enough. They don't
like
that. They don't think that's
good enough.
Well,
yeah, but that's because they don't understand the illness.
Right.
You know, like if you – this is extremely complicated, maybe more so than any other illness, because even people that have it and recover from it for over long periods of time are as just as baffled as anybody else as to why – you know, why did he do that? You know, well, damned if I know.
What's up with these addicts?
You know?
And the other thing that's happening now is that one of the dirty little secrets, I'm also going to present this, it takes on average about 4 treatments in 5 years to get 1 year of sobriety with alcohol. And so now I'm wondering, I got to look at that data more carefully because I don't know 4 treatments, those 3 days, those 2 weeks, those 2 months.
Right.
What are those 4?
And who did they ask? Is he, how much of a liar is he?
We're going to have to leave this conversation at that.
Recovery is a cumulative effort.
Well, it's a human effort. It's
no,
a,
but I mean, I don't think
of
the treatment
effort.
Is a failure and then a success if the person finds sobriety. I look at my life like I went to treatment because a girlfriend of mine's dad got sober and she wanted me to get sober.
But again,
and one thing led to the other, for 9 years, and then I got sober.
Bob, brains heal other brains. That's it. It's a human condition with a human solution.
And it is a brain disease.
It's a brain disease, a brain and body.
Finally. It's not a moral. I mean, that's what.
I know, but those winds are a blowing again.
Oh,
I got news
for you. That's why. Why do you think I brought it up? I
like
was
I said,
there.
Every time I hear him talk, it's 1936.
That's right.
I was just in the moral issue of the whole thing.
All right. We got to wrap it up. Thank you, as
you're
always.
Thank
for
you.
Thanks
time.
For having me.
It's our
thank
pleasure.
You guys.
We'll see you next time.
fine, I'll be fine, I'll be fine.